Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener, to episode 41 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. Scott, you're with me. How are you?
Oh, I'm not too bad, thanks, Trevor. How's yourself?
I'm very well. I think, Scott, that this is a special episode.
It is a special episode, yes.
I mean, somewhere out there, there's a few folk who have been with us from the beginning. They've listened to the previous 40 episodes. They tune in every week to our shenanigans, and they think, what the hell is going to happen with these two?
Yeah.
So we've got some news for you. Especially the dear loyal listeners, the ones who have been with us from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
Of this madcap adventure. And the news is that the adventure is going to be even more madcap because the secular party has decided in its wisdom that the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove are ideal candidates to represent, well, Queensland in the Australian Senate. And they're going to put us... So in a moment of madness on Sunday, they voted that, yours truly and the Velvet Glove are worthy of stepping up to the plate and fighting the good fight in the name of secularism in the upcoming Senate, well, upcoming election, but in particular for us in the Senate. So
yes.
So there you go. That'll be interesting,
Scott.
So,
ladies and gentlemen, if you're going to be voting for the secular party, which we hope you will be voting for Trevor first and myself second.
Yes. So, look, I reckon, Scott, I can count on about 150 votes. How many have you got, up your sleeve?
Probably around about 100. So that's 250. So we've just got to get another 200. We've just got to get another 249,000 votes, and we're right.
Is that what we need? About is it? Well, 7%, is it? We'll have to look it up. We'll do that for the next.
We'll
podcast.
Have to look it up. Yes, absolutely.
We need a target to aim for. I think the figure was 7%, but
that's a double dissolution figure. So yes, that would be about right.
Yeah, so what that tallies up to in actual numbers, we'll work out. And dear listener, I mean, if you've been with us for a while or if you've been with us for a week, we absolutely need all the help we can get, I can assure you.
Yes, we do need, look, this is, I'll be the one that's the most crass about the two of us.
Yes.
We need you, ladies and gentlemen, to put your hand in your pocket. We need some money, and so you go to the Secular Party website and click on the donate button, and that'll take you through to the PayPal page, or we'll give you just the bank account details that you can drop money into.
That would be great, because
absolutely
we've barely got enough money to even cover nomination fees, let alone printing a few flyers to tell people what we're on about.
Absolutely.
So if it's $20, that would be appreciated. So
absolutely. It really would be appreciated. So thank you very much from the bottom of our hearts.
Yes. And it's tax deductible. So there you go.
It is tax deductible, yes.
Donate straight to the... And mention us when you do it. Like, send us a little note or let us know that you've thought of us as you've made the donation. That would be good.
Yes, for sure.
So the other news is Scott has ordered a microphone, and hopefully maybe next week or the week after we'll have crystal clear audio from Scott. So thank you to our Patreon who has helped fund our microphone. And so our audio will be improved, although tonight if you're very if you've got a keen ear, you'll notice that Scott's suffering a little bit from the... from a bit of a cold, so...
I'll survive.
So, before we leave the potential, our candidacy as in the Senate, Scott, as you know, quickly drafted up a bit of a flyer this afternoon.
Yes, I saw that, yes.
A proposed flyer, sort of a pithy document, one page, A4, and kind of, well, the way I've structured it, and I'm yet to get feedback from the other members. Scott thinks it's okay.
And, yeah, I think it's okay, yeah.
I'm interested in feedback from you, dear listener. But basically, I've sort of constructed it as a little bit of a quiz or a test. Do you agree with the secular party? And then there's a series of questions. You know, do you support abolishing special tax exemptions currently available to religious organisations? Question number one. Anyway, series of 13 questions, and then that you can compare it to what the secular party position is on each of those 13. And at the bottom of it, I've put, how did you score out of the 13 questions? And you know, commonly with these things, you've got little bands of, you know, ranges that you might be in. So I've put, if you scored zero, sorry, you must be Tony Abbott. And if you've scored between one and three, okay, you're not Tony Abbott, but you're potentially an evangelical neoliberal. And then we go all the way up to, if you scored between 11 and 13, not only should you vote for the secular party, you should become a member. So the Queensland branch members will be discussing that flyer and no doubt cutting bits and pieces and making amendments, but we'd like some money so we can print it and distribute it and get people talking about the secular party, because nobody is at the moment, that's for sure.
We've had a little bit of success on Facebook, but you know, it's a big gap between getting people to click like on Facebook and getting people to a branch meeting.
Yeah, then that's fair enough. Yeah. Like, that's okay. If they click like and then vote would be, I'd be happy with that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Speaking of Facebook, though, I reckon we've got one of the most active Facebooks of a. Certainly of a small political party, and even, you know, you can, in Facebook, you can compare to other like organisations, and given our very, very small size, our Facebook page, run by Karen these days, is humming along very, very well. So if you haven't seen the secular party, if you haven't been in there, have a look, because there's the sort of stuff we talk about often pops up as articles and comments in there, and... Well, I steal items from there, and maybe Karen steals items from me. I'm not sure, but anyway, have a look at that. So okay, enough of the general pre-election admin hype, Scott. We'll launch into our usual potpourri of secular type topics.
Yes, and this week we've got a bit from everyone, although the Catholics do feature fairly prominently. But
Yep, good mix. And first up, what do you think of Telstra, Scott?
Ah, look, you know, back in the day when you had no choice but to go with them, you were stuck with them. These days you've got a choice. And I'm fortunate that I don't have anything with Telstra. I have everything with Optus. And, you know, it's probably not a bad move because, you know, they've bowed down to pressure from the Archdiocese of Sydney. The business manager, Michael Diggs, wrote to corporations whose logos featured in the with their permission on a full-page Australian marriage equality advertisement in May last year, implying it would withdraw its custom.
We reported on that letter.
We did.
When it happened, yes.
Yes. And Telstra has quietly retreated from a public campaign pushing for same-sex marriage after it kowtowed to the Catholic Church with threatened a boycott of companies involved in supporting a change to the definition of the traditional union. It's not really all that surprising that they took that position. I mean, Telstra provides the... internet for all of Catholic Ed across the country.
Yep.
And presumably they also provide the phone services and so on and so forth. So it gets up there with what they'd be spending on a monthly basis. But, you know, my question comes back to this. if they had actually told Telstra to go take a running jump at themselves, who the hell were they going to get them to sign up with anyway?
Exactly.
Exactly. Telstra really was in a position to turn around and say, well, you know, you're free to go wherever you wish, but we don't think you're going to find another company that supports the traditional view of marriage.
Exactly. They were just gutless.
They were gutless, yes.
And it's appalling behaviour by the Catholic Church because they're getting money from the public purse to run these schools, and then they're threatening to withhold that money because of, you know, their hang-ups over sex.
Yeah.
And in any event, Scott, I don't know if you're aware, but then apparently Telstra has then done a further backflip on its backflip. So in recent times, there's been communication from them to sort of move away again from that position, and I don't know, they're in some sort of neutral territory, or now they are pro-gay. But I think the damage has been done from Telstra's point of view is that not only are they a pathetic telephone organisation when you have to deal with them, but their moral sense is as bad as their service. So
it is as bad as their service. I mean, I'm not speaking out of school here, but Joe, one of the guys from the secular party, he was there on Sunday, and he said that there was a Yammer or some type of internal Twitter sphere that people get to comment on.
Right.
And after this came out, they were rank, that the staff were up in arms about this.
So, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, the company's done the wrong thing, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, and anyway, we'll see where it all ends up, but
You know, yet another example of poor behaviour by the Catholic Church in the first place, of writing to all these companies saying, we're going to withdraw our business if you don't fall back from your position supporting gay marriage. What a pack of, I don't know, as a potential candidate for the Senate, do I have to temper my language now, Scott?
I don't think we're going to win anyway, so, you know.
dear listener, if you get the sense that I'm holding back because suddenly I'm trying to be, you know, politically correct or something, you know, send me a message and take me to task, because I think we've just got to keep going the way we're going. You've got to be true to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
We do. So, all right, so that's we fired off our first cannon at the Catholic Church, and I'm sure there'll be more by the time we get to the end of the podcast.
Yeah, for sure. Mm.
The Iron Fist, the Velvet Glove, and the 12th Man are all members of the Secular Party. There may be other contributors to the show who are also members. That does not mean that every opinion given on this show is policy of the Secular Party. To find out what is policy, go to the website of the Secular Party. And while you're there, think about joining and signing up, because we need more secularists in this world. Thanks. Scott, I am increasingly intrigued by the Institute of Public Affairs.
Yes, I've noticed that, yes. Yeah.
I'm a little bit wary of becoming some sort of conspiracy theorist. I don't think I am yet. I'm conscious it's possible, but
let yourself go there, you know.
Just, well, groups like the Institute of Public Affairs, they've been so subtly working away in our system that we don't even recognise that they've been doing what they're doing. And I think that Scott, if you know, when we're luxuriating in the leather of the Senate seats, what colour is the Senate? Green or
Senate's red? Yes, it's okay. Red.
So as we're sitting back, smelling the leather of the Senate seats, and people are wondering what we're doing, plotting against the Institute of Public Affairs will certainly be high on my list as I'm sitting there.
And you know, you've got damn good reason to plot against the Institute of Public Affairs. You know, it's crazy what they've been up to.
They're an insidious force. So I've got this article that I've linked to, and it's by Elizabeth Farrelly from the Sydney Morning Herald. Institute of Public Affairs, the think tank with arms everywhere. And I'll read a few bits and pieces from the article. Question: when is libertarianism not liberating? Answer: when it is really a feudalistic patriarchy, a trompe-l'oeil of birds and flowers hiding a hard-head, pile-driving agenda. In particular, when it's the low-profile but remarkably influential Institute of Public Affairs. Well, there's a good opening sentence, Scott.
Absolutely.
I looked up French Trump. Look, I didn't learn French, and my French pronunciation. I Trump l'air is literally a trick of the eye. So sometimes when you see people, you know, they do a painting on a wall and it looks like you could walk through the wall because it's kind of three-dimensional, and
that's a
Trump l'air trick of the eye. Yeah. And this journalist is saying, well, that's what the Institute of Public Affairs is. It's a trick of the eye. You think it's one thing, but it's really another thing. So, let me see here. It's saying that Australian politics is like one of those World War II towns with its street signs turned awry to confuse the dreaded Hun. We all know this is good. We all know that the Liberals are not liberal, the Nationals are not national, and the IPA is not some august public interest watchdog stamped with official gravitas. Well, listeners to a lot of people wouldn't know the third one, but listeners to this podcast should know by now that that's the case. And
so true.
So she says it's about who and what is driving the national political agenda, and she makes the point that the IPA has three member senators. Now, this is going to trick me on the pronunciation. That David Lionhelm
from Liberal Democrats.
Thank you,
New South Wales.
Bob Day and James Patterson are all...
Bob Day is from the Family First, and he's from South Australia.
Yep. James Patterson we've talked about.
Yes.
And then there's a fourth one coming in namely Tim Wilson, former Human Rights Commissioner. All members of the IPA. So it used to be that the IPA would just be in the background proposing policies and providing misleading statistics wherever possible to support those policies, and sort of convincing politicians to, you know, the Liberal Party to take up those policies. But they're now gone a step further and actually got people in there, into Parliament, actually doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
It's a Tea Party type scenario, Scott.
It certainly looks that way. I mean, I remember when this Senate first got sworn in, and, you know, there was a ghast at the number of crossbenchers that there were. And Bob Day and David Lionhelm both said that they could work with each other economically, but in terms of some of their social policies, then they could go with one another. Mm. But, you know, it was very interesting that they made that point economically anyway.
Just to give people an idea of how powerful this group is, at its 70th birthday gala dinner in 2013, Rupert Murdoch gave the keynote, News Corp's Andrew Bolt was MC, and opposition leader Tony Abbott called the IPA Freedom's Discerning Friend. Gina Reinhart, George Pell, George Brandis, and Alan Jones were guests. Like, these are powerful, influential people with access to a lot of media, Scott, who can put forward an agenda. It's, you know, that sort of access to the megaphone of the media is, that's a lot of power.
It is, you know, I mean, well, we've seen what Gina Reinhart's been capable of doing.
Hmm.
And, you know, with her in the IPA's corner, with the IPA in Gina Reinhart's corner, then we, you know, it's, she could actually not, she could actually move the IPA agenda forward on her own.
Right. Yep. You count her as that influential? Yep.
Well, she could, yeah. I mean, like, she's, she was trying to buy Fairfax out from under them.
That's right, and she was. Yeah.
Yeah. Fairfax ruled against her because she wanted, I don't know if she wanted full editorial control, but she wanted she wanted some sort of control over the editorial life of the papers.
Yes. Yep.
And the rest of the board said no. So I think she's sold out since.
Yeah. I'm sure her fellow members of the IPA were encouraging her to buy it because that would have been just another outlet for their views to be propagated.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Mm. Yeah. So still on articles, there's another one here that I've linked to from the John Menadue blog that we are big fans of. And this is from a guy called Greg Bailey, talking just generally, again, about Institute of Public Affairs. And he says there's two reasons for the IPA's success. The first is in insinuating itself into the media at all levels. And in the 2015 annual report of the IPA, they boast of 81 mentions in federal parliament, 762 appearances in the print media, 411 appearances on radio, and 184 appearances on TV. That's an extraordinary number, Scott, for a year.
Yeah,
from a lobby group.
Yeah.
And, you know, they even get to appear on, you know, Q&A on the ABC, which suggests that they have successfully mainstreamed themselves.
Well, they're not only just turning up on Q&A, they turn up on the, Chris Berg's a regular on The Drum.
Mm.
Every afternoon at 5:30.
I haven't heard him. Have you heard him?
I have heard him, yeah.
Right. Is he subtle about it or is he over the top?
No, he's fairly subtle, but, you know, he also... when he's been backed into a corner, he's not subtle at all. Mm. He really does go hard when he's backed into the corner. But generally speaking, I'd say he's subtle.
Okay. The second reason for the IPA's success, as recorded in this article, is its strong historical connection with the Liberal Party. Most of the board members are either members of or closely associated with the Liberal Party. And as you said, Bob Day is a member, and so is David Lionhelm.
Lionhelm, yeah.
Good, got it right now. The Liberal Democrats. So, our friend James Patterson recently, who's just got into the Senate, on his elevation to the Senate, wrote to all the members of the IPA and said, "I want you to know that I'm going to the Senate to fight for exactly the same things I have in my time at the IPA. I know if I ever fail to do so, that IPA members will be the first to let me know where I've gone wrong." And
I had to admit, I agreed with what the author wrote after that. He said, I mistakenly thought he would be representing his state of Victoria, not the IPA.
Indeed. Yeah.
You know, and that is something that really, it really, really does wreck that he would go in there and say that he will do as the IPA asks.
Yes. Well, as he's already said in the IPA, like, so James Patterson, John Roskam and Chris Berg published an article just back when... Tony Abbott was elected, and it was titled "Be Like Gough: 75 Radical Ideas to Transform Australia." So this is the sort of charter of the IPA, and
yeah, and you've got that one listed, haven't you?
Well, I will. I've got a link to it. Like, so yeah. These are 75 things.
Go through the 75 things that they're actually after.
I can't go through all 75, but let's just... I can tell you that they're the 75 of the most... Well, nearly every one of them is abhorrent to right-thinking Australians, Scott. I mean...
Well, okay, if I went through and actually found things that I agree with. Repeal Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act.
Yep, I was okay with that.
Fine. That was okay with that.
Yep.
And I thought there was...
You managed to find one other, did you?
I thought I did, but apparently not. Rule out federal funding for the 2018 Commonwealth Games. Well, God knows how Queensland's supposed to pay for that.
I'll pick out some that really... return income taxing powers to the states. Hey, that might have been one that you agreed with, because you were kind of on that. Hey, this might be my best argument yet, Scott, to convince you of the error of your ways on that argument. If I was to tell you that that's number 7 on the IPA list, you'd... Anyway, here we go. Here's some. Abolish the ACCC. Like, why would you do that?
Why would you do that?
Yeah, because you're big business and you want to screw people.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, repeal the national curriculum. Why would you want a national curriculum where all Australians' kids are taught the same thing? Goodness me. Mm. Introduce competing private secondary school curriculums. Yeah, that's classic neoliberalism. Competition is great and just abominable. Eliminate family tax benefits. Oh, introduce voluntary voting because they figure that poor people won't be bothered voting.
That was one I did agree with, introducing voluntary voting.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay. We should talk about that one another time. End mandatory disclosures on political donations.
Well, I mean, that's just absurd.
That's what everybody's clamouring for, aren't they? Like,
yeah.
Clearly because you want to be able to pump money into the Liberal Party and not have it known where it's coming from.
Exactly.
End media blackout in final days of election campaigns. Like,
yeah, see, that's just ridiculous.
Why? Because you want to put some dodgy, last-minute, fraudulent, misleading ad out there?
Yeah.
Abolish the Foreign Investment Review Board because you want foreigners to be able to come in and buy anything whenever and wherever they like. Like, these are just some of the neoliberal, hardcore neoliberal ideas that this group believes in. And, dear listener, they are leaning so heavily on the Liberal Party that many of these ideas are raised and given a good shove by them, and it's extremely dangerous.
Well, it is extremely dangerous. You know, end all government funding and nanny state advertising. You know, I mean, like, nanny state is something that we've heard that being mentioned in Parliament before. You know, it's crazy. Means testing tertiary student loans. I mean, what are they going to do? Have different interest rates depending on how wealthy your parents are?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a host of things in there. 75 things the IPA will do. So be very, very careful and watchful of the IPA over the coming years. So that's enough on the IPA for the moment, Scott. next up, we'll move from the IPA to the Glenview State School on the Sunshine Coast of Queensland.
Wasn't that amazing?
So this is a state school.
Yeah.
Funded by public money.
Yes.
And, dear listener, you know, we unfortunately have religious instruction classes in Queensland. I'll digress for a moment, Scott. Remember how we're trying to get those changed in Queensland? I had a chat to the PNC Association, and they have no position on religious instruction classes. So they're neither for nor against, and so they've heard what I've got to say, and I think they're going to sort of, well, we're talking about it. I want to do some sort of presentation to their board, and I think I'll be writing something to them, giving the reasons why we should not have RI in Queensland. So anyway, begun discussions with them, still waiting to hear from the Principals Association, and of course we've got the teachers union on side. So
yeah,
that's a progress report on religious indoctrination classes in Queensland. But for the moment, they're still here, and schools, state schools, can Bible bash kids for an hour a week. And the Glenview State School is certainly doing that. Like, the Sunshine Coast is a hotbed of evangelical nutbags, Scott. Up there.
It is crazy, isn't it?
And in, you know, most schools seem to be, I think, you know, fairly neutral in the sense of, well, whatever people have put on the enrollment form, that should be their decision as to whether they want religious instruction or not, in the main. But this mob at Glenview State School have written to all the parents saying, why consider Christian religious instruction? And they've basically quite a lengthy blurb giving reasons why parents should enroll their kids in Christian religious instruction classes. And they've really gone to town, Scott.
I printed it out, and it's 3 pages long.
Yep.
So, 2 2/3 pages. But they really have gone to town on it. You're exactly right for saying that, because they have gone, above and beyond what they ought to have done.
Yeah. So, a big list.
It makes me wonder, sorry to cut you off, but it makes me wonder if the principal that would have signed off on this, whether or not he's a, or he or she is a Bible nutter.
Oh, I'm sure the principal would be. You couldn't possibly let this go out unless you were... I bet he's in the pulpit every Sunday. He'd have to be.
Probably, yeah.
Mm. So, like number two, the reasons. Number two, to give informed answers to your child's spiritual questions. Who made God? Who wrote the Bible? Will my pet go to heaven? These are heartfelt questions that require informed and sensitive answers. It'll be good, Scott. An informed answer as to whether your pet will go to heaven. Like, I'm keen to see how they achieve an informed answer on that.
Exactly. You can be confident the answers to your child's questions are not simply being plucked out of the air, and they are dealt with at the appropriate developmental level. I mean, how the hell can you say, "Oh, your pet goes to heaven"? It's just you can't.
But based on the first paragraph, I don't have the confidence that they have. And here we have a third reason, to help informing your child's personal, ethical, and moral framework.
I really hated that.
Christian RI can be invaluable in the process of shaping a child's ethical and moral framework and helping them make sense of the world. Alongside the school's teaching on morals, values, and acceptable social behaviour, Christian RI provides guidelines in the areas of relationships and personal moral growth based on biblical worldview.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's crazy because, they're talking about, where was that, in the area of relationships. Yeah, I mean, provided they're heterosexual relationships, it's crazy stuff to actually write this nonsense. And then number four, number four, to broaden your child's education on a purely practical level, an understanding of the Bible and Christian thinking is vital in our culture. The writing's on the wall, and I, my brother's keeper. These sayings are from the Bible. Well, Trevor, I'm sure you knew those sayings were from the Bible. But, I'm also, might be going out on a limb here, but I'm suggesting that you didn't have the most Christian of upbringings, would that be right?
Well, actually, I didn't know that they were from the Bible.
Oh, didn't you?
But when I see the writings on the wall, all I can think of is the life of Brian, where he writes in Latin on the wall and the centurion corrects his Latin. So...
The writing that's on the wall was from the Bible.
Yeah. Well, okay. I didn't know either of them from the Bible, but my thoughts on the Bible, Scott.
Yeah, I know that.
But anyway, what a sell job by this school. Basically, just talk about Bible bashing.
Yeah, it is.
So anyway, we've got to thank for that the Queensland Parents for Secular State Schools, who have a Facebook. You should follow that, dear listener. And they are regularly looking at exactly what's happening on the ground in state schools. Great little group. And it's a like that sort of stuff, Scott, is what absolutely keeps me going with this, because it's horrendous that that's happening in a state school.
It really is disgusting, yeah.
Mm, yes.
For sure.
Scott, can you hear helicopters in the background?
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Bronwyn Bishop has the long illustrious career of Bronwyn Bishop has come to an end.
Yes,
it was sad but inevitable. I mean, look, this had nothing to do with her age. You know, even at 73, she's still easily up to the rigours of the job and more intellectually capable than the majority of MPs. In her case, it was time to go because she had burrowed so deeply into self-referential values of machine politics that she had lost track of the community values she was sent to uphold. Hear, hear. I agree wholeheartedly with that, Mark Kenny. You've hit the nail right on the head. You know, it's... and then we've got one for then after that. Nowhere was this more acutely evident than in the conduct and mismanagement of her signature stuff-up, the so-called Choppergate scandal. And nowhere was it more chronically evident than in her shameless partisan performance of Speaker of the House of Representatives. You know, it's so true. She was incredibly biased in the Speaker's chair. It was just embarrassing, really. I mean, you know, she had ejected 400 and something members from the House over the time that she was in there. 392 of them were Labor. Right. 8 of them were Coalition. You know, it was ridiculous.
That must have been eight Coalition members wanting a toilet break, were they?
Well, I don't know, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me.
She was just helping them out.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah, but she's gone, and, you know... Goodbye and good luck to you, Miss Bishop. You'll be fine on your $2,500 a week.
She kind of made her name early on in sort of Senate committee type questioning, where she would
berate
poor public servants and
get
stuck into them in a school mistressy authoritarian sort of manner that sort of brought her to public attention, and people liked it at the time because they thought she was battling against government waste, but in fact she was just being an old cow, probably.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, it was. I remember when Choppergate came up. You know, she was asked whether or not it embarrassed her and that sort of stuff, and you know, she didn't really have a proper answer for that.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
I'm just saying, in my defence, you know, when I said earlier on in the podcast, if I appear to be backing off and not being my normal self, trying to smooth, just simply declaring Bronwyn Bishop an old cow is probably letting, you know, I think people have relaxed now. The fist is still here.
The fist is still here. Yes, that's very true. You know, the one thing that Kenny did put down, if there's a risk to her forced departure, it is that she will now be free to explain her side of that crisis. Well, I can't wait for the tell-all book to come out, and because I will be buying that one.
I think the rumor is she wanted to apologise earlier, and Tony Abbott said no or something like that. Wasn't that like that's isn't that what's perhaps going to come out if she gets a chance to say something?
She didn't really apologise when she was given the opportunity to on the first occasion. You know, she said, "Well, I've paid it back. That's apology enough for you." You know, which was pretty disgusting.
Anyway, she flies off into the distance.
Exactly. Goodbye, Bronwyn.
Yes. Now, Scott, we've talked about universities and safe spaces.
Yes, we have.
You know, I reckon we sort of, again, led the pack on this in terms of Australia. We sort of talked about it happening overseas and, you know, there's been, you know, things in the news more recently about safe spaces and universities in Australia, and we'll talk about one instance a bit later on, but... just on that whole notion, I mean, a university should be a place of vibrant and willing debate, Scott, I would have thought.
It really should be, yes. Yeah.
And an article here making the point that these students who are saying, well, you can't say that, this is a safe space, you know, we need trigger warnings, you know, people are being hurt by these words and, you know, can't have that speaker come to the university because that's going to offend people. Well, what happens is that the powers that be are now using those arguments to stop student protests about things.
Yes.
So an interesting article where at Ohio State University, there was a protest inside a university building and the students conducted some sort of sit-in. And the argument used by the university officials was... that, in fact, their actions were scaring the office staff in the building and it was no longer a safe space. And for that reason alone, they should vacate the building. And So it's a good little point there that insofar as campus concepts like safe spaces, microaggressions, and claims of trauma over minor altercations spread from activist culture to campus culture, the powerful will inevitably make use of them. Goes on to say, but basically you get the gist that if you're going to cry about safe spaces and on denying people coming onto the university to talk and do anything, then your own student activist protests will be silenced for the same reason, and you can't really complain then.
Exactly. You know, it was crazy for them to carry on the way they did. And unfortunately, their protest activities have been shut down.
So, actually, Scott, let me skip through. I'm going to find that article. Sorry to do things out of order, but we should address it. The QUT situation.
Yeah, that one really struck me.
Were you aware of that one before?
I was aware of that one. It came up on the Facebook page.
Right. Let me find this. QUT Computer Lab. So, basically, there was a bunch of three QUT students who were looking to use a computer at a university, and they stumbled across this room and walked in, saw some computers there, and said, "Can we use these computers?" And there was a lady there, it turned out to be Aboriginal, who said, "Well, are you guys Aboriginal?" And they said, "No." And she said, "Well, this is just this is an Aboriginal computer room for just Indigenous people. So if you're not First Peoples, you can't use it." So they left. But what they then did was make some comments on Facebook, which, in the scheme of things, Scott, wasn't so bad. One of them said, "Just got kicked out of the unsigned Indigenous computer room. QUT is stopping segregation with segregation." And one of the other ones wrote, "I wonder where the white supremacist lab is," which I thought had a bit of sense of humour to it anyway. And then, but what's happened is that the lady involved has heard about the Facebook pages, has taken umbrage at them, is claiming that her, you know, safe space is violated, etc. She's taken these kids to court, and she's taken the university to court, and she's saying that she can't operate in that room anymore unless she's got a personal guard at the door to make sure that you know, only acceptable people come in. And it's just a nightmare at QUT for, I really feel, for three pretty innocent kids who have, or students who have walked in, didn't put up a fuss at the time, walked out, made a few comments on Facebook, and now facing up to $200,000 in legal fees if it goes to trial because of what's going on. So I guess the point of that article, Scott, is that these safe spaces that we've been talking about in universities are all that sort of stuff is across the Pacific and the Atlantic, I guess, coming from the UK as well. It's here. It's happening.
It is here. It is happening here. And, you know, I think that one of the things that struck me was that she said she was unable to return to work in a role that required her to have face-to-face contact with white people. You know, I found that really bizarre that she would say that. I would have thought that wherever she went, she'd have to have face-to-face contact with white people.
You would think so. But, you know, this is like the people who, you know, you're an airline stewardess, oh, you're Muslim, you can't serve alcohol. Or, you know, you're a checkout operator and you can't sell people pork. Or, you know, these sorts of arguments you hear about. Like, the answer to that is that if your job is, if your religious convictions or other convictions prevent you from doing a job, get a different job. Like, if that's what's going on. So it's similar to that sort of thing where you've got just a nonsensical reason for refusing to do something. Well, if that's your choice, then get a different job if you can't do that job. So that's what I would be saying.
Well, that's the way I say too. I mean, I think that she should get herself a different job.
Mm. Anyway, that's QUT. We'll see what happens with that one. It's been going on for a while.
It has been going on for a while, yeah.
Flying Spaghetti Monster, we've mentioned occasionally.
Yeah, I noticed this one coming out of the out of court in the United States, saying that Flying Spaghetti Monster is not a religion. Go on.
Yeah, well, a judge had to sort of look at the Flying Spaghetti Monster, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, and ascertain whether it was a genuine religion or not. And he basically came to the conclusion, which I can't criticise, is that while it's got all the normal trappings of a religion, it's clearly done as satire and is not genuinely held. So can't really argue with him about that.
No, it's pretty hard to argue with him. I mean, he's probably hit the nail right on the head.
I thought the... and there's some words there as to why that's the case. The interesting thing is that the whole reason for this court case is there was a prisoner seeking accommodation of his Pastafarian faith while he's in prison. So anyway, the Pastafarians, while they can be conducting marriage ceremonies in New Zealand, if you're a if you're a prisoner in Nebraska, it's not going to cut the mustard. You're out of luck.
Oh dear.
Well, here's another one, Scott. Ted Cruz.
Ah, he is really giving me the irrits.
Well, dear listener, this is from Ted Cruz. Believe it or not, according to Ted Cruz, Americans have no right to masturbate. There you go.
Yes, I mean, I found that incredible. He said that when he was, where was he?
Texas Solicitor General.
Solicitor General of Texas, yes. You know, I found that incredible that he would actually say that in his position that he was holding at the time.
Yes.
And then years later, to be running for, you know, the nomination for the Republican Party, you know, to then sort of cry foul that people had brought this up, I found that rather bizarre.
Look, we call a lot of people religious right-wing nutters. But
yeah,
but anyone who actually gets up and says that Americans have no right to masturbate, I reckon, is clearly within that definition. Dear listener, the reason that this came about was that Texas, this is back in 2008, Cruz, as the Solicitor General for Texas, was defending a Texas ban on the sale of dildos and other sex toys, and in doing so made the absurd claim that Americans have no right to masturbate. And we're going to quote Ted Cruz here. Quote, "There is no substantive due process right to stimulate one's genitals for non-medical purposes unrelated to procreation or outside of an interpersonal relationship." End quote.
What? It's crazy that he would say that when he was Solicitor General. You know, I mean, it's
just... And this man's running for president, and this is...
Yeah. You know, I love this bit here too. He says, "I'm a Christian first and American second."
Yes.
You know, for God's sake, he's running for the presidency. Well, he's not for the presidency yet, but he's running to become one of the Republican Party's nominees, and he's coming out with this crap.
Yeah, this is so good. I've got to repeat this. "There is no substantive due process..." He's in a court of law at the time as the Texas Solicitor General, and he's standing up and saying, "There is no substantive due process right to stimulate one's genitals for non-medical purposes unrelated to procreation or outside of an interpersonal relationship." You've got no right to play with yourself, according to Ted Cruz.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
The other part of this article is, I really like this, that... Ted Cruz was a freshman roommate, a freshman at Princeton,
yes.
And his roommate, Craig Mazin, has tweeted, "Ted Cruz thinks people don't have a right to stimulate their genitals. I was his college roommate. This would be
a new belief of his. What has the world come to, Scott?
It is crazy, isn't it, that he would actually come out and say that stuff? You know, it's ridiculous.
What has the world come to? That's one of my favourite all-time articles, that one.
Yeah, it really is up there.
Are you enjoying the show and would you like to help out? There's a few easy things you can do. You can like us on Facebook and you can go into iTunes and leave a positive review. That would be much appreciated. Also, if you're really keen, you could donate to us via Patreon. For details on how to do all this, visit our website. Thanks for your support. And now, back to the podcast.
Now, back to the Catholics.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
In Melbourne, a priest, Father Bill Eddie Bowles, the parish priest at St. Mary's Primary School in Malvern East, took aim at lawyers and the media for not showing enough mercy during the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. Goes on to say that the media and lawyers, like the baying crowd of men in the gospel, ready to throw stones, don't understand the need for a justice that is drenched in mercy, according to Father Eddie Bowles. But he went on to say, maybe to get the real drama and effect of the story, we ought to replace the adulterous woman with a paedophile priest, he wrote. Goes on, he is without sin, let him cast a stone at her. So basically makes the argument that really we should just, you know, compare a paedophile priest with an adulterous woman and show the same level of mercy. And that didn't go down well with a lot of people, Scott.
I can't imagine why not.
Living in another...
I mean, like that was crazy for him to actually bother to say that in the first place. I mean, the story he's talking about was when Christ intervened with a... there was an angry mob that was going to stone an adulterous woman. Excuse me. And they came up with all the arguments that, you know, she's adulterous, therefore we have to stone her. Mm. And that's when Christ then said, but he that is without sin cast the first stone.
Mm.
You know, but that had nothing to do with pedophilia at all. You know?
No, he's compared adultery, which is a, you know, just a bit of a moral question, with pedophilia, which is clearly something else. So,
which is clearly criminal, yeah.
Exactly. And he's just equated the two and, again, shown how out of touch our members of the clergy of the Catholic faith are.
Yeah, exactly.
Scott, time for the quiz.
Of course, the quiz.
Before next week, I'm going to have a little intro music or sting or something for the quiz. So, I'll let you get off to a quick start with a 1-point easy victory. Well, 2-party preferred, Liberal National versus Labor. What are we sitting at?
49 to Liberals, 51 to the Labor Party.
Really? What one was that? Because I'm...
That was Ipsos, I believe.
Really? Okay, I've got 50-50 on this one from the Central Report. Okay. But they're all, you know, obviously errors, a margin of error in all polling, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. Royal Commission into Banking. Would you support or oppose holding a Royal Commission into the banking and financial services industry? This is the one proposed by the Labor Party, Bill Shorten. So how many people support a Royal Commission into Banking? How many oppose?
65%.
All right.
65% are in favour.
All right.
Around about 20% are opposed, and the balance, I don't know.
Okay, very good. 59 support, 15% oppose, and 25% I don't know. So that's pretty close, Scott. 2 points there. You're 2 out of 2. I'll give that one. I didn't think it'd be that high. I thought people might be Royal Commissioned out, but anyway.
Well, apparently not. Apparently they're all gung-ho for getting a Royal Commission into the banks.
Mm. Let's see here. Uh, different ones on funding of schools, but I think I'm just going to leave those. Buying a house. Do you think it's easier or harder for young people to buy a house than it was for their parents' generation?
It's harder.
How many said harder and how many said easier?
Probably 70% said harder, 20% said easier, and 10% said don't know.
Yeah, 76 said harder and 7 right. said easier, and 13% don't know. Okay. So I'll give you that one too, Scott. You're 3 out of 3. finding a job, is it harder or easier for young people to find a well-paid job than it was for their parents' generation?
I'd probably say it's harder for young people to find a job. Probably 60% would say harder, 30% would say it's easier, and 10% would say don't know.
Pretty close. 55 say it's harder, 17 say it's easier. Who are these people? Like, who would say it's... And 23% say that it's about the same. But 17% of people think it's easier to get a job now than it was for their parents. That...
See, I find that ridiculous. I mean, like, admittedly, I came out of uni at the time when we were at the pit of the recession.
Right.
And, you know, so I was very lucky to get a job.
Yep.
You know, mates of mine, it did take them quite a long time to get work, but they did all find work.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
I finished my law degree, I think it was around about 86 or something. Because I took a year off and travelled and did another... maybe it was about 87 or something like that.
Yeah.
Late-ish 80s. And yeah. Law degree was a four-year degree. And in the middle of third year, I had a job guaranteed and lined up when I finished fourth year with a big firm right. in the city. Like,
yeah.
That's how easy it was to get a job, Scott.
Yeah.
Now... there are lawyers in South Australia, young kids coming out of law school, who are actually paying $20,000 to work as a lawyer so they can just get the experience under their belt so they can go off and do something somewhere. They're paying for a job.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Dear listener, some of you know me quite well. If I meet young people who are thinking of studying law, I do my absolute best to talk them out of it. And if you've got a child, a teenager, or you yourself are thinking about studying law to practice as a lawyer, get in contact and I'll give you all lots of reasons why not to. Terrible job. So there we go. So that's Scott. You did very well on the Scott. I think you were like 4 out of 4 on that. Your best ever performance, worthy of a vote in the Senate with that sort of finger on the pulse of the Australian public. Speaking of not having a finger on the pulse, that would be Pope Francis, I reckon.
Yeah, he's getting to be really crazy, isn't he?
Well, just. The more he talks, the more he expresses his true opinions.
I know. It's ridiculous. It's just, you know, he started off all okay. You know, making statements about evolution and all that sort of stuff. But just lately, he's really gone off the deep end. And I suppose it's in the, you know, the usual sort of thing. He's talking about sex and that sort of stuff. So he's starting to lose it.
As soon as a Catholic clergyman starts talking about sex... like, an alarm bell should just be ringing in their head and like, oh, this shouldn't be a topic I should talk about. Like, they, whatever they, you know, spend in the time they spend in the seminary learning stuff, Catholic Clergy 101 lesson should be just never, ever talk about sex because you're going to get it wrong because you know nothing about it.
Exactly.
And the Pope here, the Pope has claimed that teaching kids about safe sex promotes narcissism and the transgender teens should be taught to accept their own body as it was created. And he wrote, this is in his report on the family, the Pope wrote that frequently sex education deals primarily with protection through the practice of safe sex. Such expressions convey a negative attitude towards the natural procreative finality of sexuality, as if an eventual child were an enemy to be protected against. Uncle Francis. It's just that people like to have sex and don't necessarily want a baby to result every time that they do, because...
Yeah, but even with all that, you know, the whole point about protection and safe sex and all that sort of stuff is because of HIV.
That could well be as well, yes. Yeah. Sexually, exactly. But it just... How out of touch. Such expressions convey a negative attitude towards the natural procreative finality of sexuality, as if an eventual child were an enemy to be protected against. Well, just as we know, the biggest cause of poverty and suffering in the world is women's inability to control their own fertility. And if we can get that sorted, then a lot of problems get solved. And Pope Francis, you're not helping with that sort of thing. And he says here, this way of thinking promotes narcissism. Scott, do you pronounce it narcissism or narcissism? It's kind of a difficult
one. Narcissism.
Okay.
Narcissism.
This way of thinking promotes narcissism and aggressively in place of acceptance. It is always irresponsible to invite adolescents to toy with their bodies and their desires as if they possessed the maturity, values, mutual commitment, and goals proper to marriage. Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah, he's just lost it.
And he tells transgender people, the young need to be helped to accept their body as it was created. For thinking that we enjoy absolute power over our own bodies turns often subtly into thinking that we enjoy absolute power over creation. So basically, accept your body as it was created, because to do otherwise would be to assume too much power over your own body that God's got. Yeah. That God's got. Not said, but implied. Ugh, disgusting.
It is disgusting, yeah.
Blight on the world, and if he came here, Scott, on a plane, there'd be people at the airport prostrating themselves on the tarmac, thinking he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and he's a monster.
He's an old, old man who wants to carry on just being an old man, that's all.
Mm.
Yeah.
Speaking of monsters, there's a few in the Aceh province in Indonesia. Have you been to Indonesia,
Scott? No, I've never been to Indonesia, and I don't think I'll ever go.
No. I mean, Aceh is just a province. It's not the whole place, but it would be uncomfortably close for my liking. And
but the fact that they've got their that they managed to get the laws there, you know, it really does open up a whole range of questions about the entire country.
It's a worry, isn't it? So the Aceh province managed to have Sharia law implemented in that province, and when it was implemented, they said that it would only apply to Muslims and that non-Muslims would not be affected in the province. And Islamic leaders sought to allay fears that non-Muslims would have to comply with Sharia law. And at the time, a few quotes here. The fact is that Muslims in Aceh do tolerate religious freedom and we can coexist without any problems. Tengu Faisal Ali, head of the provincial chapter of the influential Muslim organisation, told Banner News at the time. We don't want to raise the impression that Islamic law in Aceh infringes on the rights of non-Muslims. It doesn't force Sharia law on non-Muslims because they are free to observe their own faiths and beliefs. Meanwhile, on the 12th of April, we've got a Christian woman caned in a public square for selling alcohol.
Yeah.
Just. Oh, no, no, no. It's... You know, let us have Sharia law. We'll only apply it to Muslims. Everyone else can do what they want to do. And then, you know, a short while later, no surprise that it's being applied to non-Muslims in the Aceh province. Christian woman flogged in a public square.
Yeah, she was flogged, and you know, and there was no good reason for that flogging either. I mean, she sold some booze, big deal,
which is done every day, every second of every hour in Bali.
In Bali, yeah, exactly. Mm. You know, and then you know, Bandar Aceh is entirely different.
Mm. Scott, I was going to talk about Operation 513, but I'll probably skip it. They're just a crazy religious group who are doing sort of street evangelizing in Brisbane, and they do a really detailed report of what they get up to every night in the mall and who they meet and what they said, and quite extraordinary sort of diarising of their activities. And have you heard of them before?
No, not until you'd actually sent this through to me, no.
Yeah.
So I hadn't, then again, I hadn't been out in a long time either.
No, I don't go into the city on Friday and Saturday nights. But if you are, dear listener, watch out for Operation 513 offering free Bibles and resources. And whatever conversation you have with them will be duly recorded and noted on their blog as they proselytize to you. And so, yeah, that's Operation 513 in Brisbane. Scott, I am going to go to the defence momentarily of Scott Morrison.
Yes, I was interested with this, yes. So do tell.
Mm. So we've got an article here. Chris Bowen, the opposition treasurer, shadow treasurer, has referred to a wake-up call from Moody's credit rating agency, speculating that there'll be a credit downgrade if certain things are not done by Scott Morrison. And the point I simply want to make, Scott, is why do we give a rat's anymore what Moody's and Standard & Poor's thinks about anything after the global financial crisis where junk bonds were rated AAA by these monkeys who know nothing? We've still got to kowtow to their opinions on whether countries are operating with fiscal responsibility enough. Just gives me the willies because they were prime players in the global financial crisis. There was rubbish financial stuff floating around that they said was fantastic. And did they pay any penalty for that at all? No.
Well, no, they haven't. And I found that incredible. Like that movie that I saw, which was the guy that took out insurance against the junk bond.
Was that The Big Short?
Yeah, The Big Short.
I haven't seen it yet, but I want to see it.
Oh, it's very good. Yeah, it is very good. And in that, they have a scene where they go into Moody's or Standard & Poor's or someone like that, and they're arguing with these people. You can't say these things are worth AAA. They're worth dogs. They're dogs breakfast.
Ah, okay, yep.
And they just sat there and said, no, they're AAA.
Right. Yep.
So you know, I mean, I found that incredible that they would. And at the time, I remember Paul Keating made the point. He was interviewed on 7:30 Report. I remember at the time he said, you know, Standard & Poor's and Moody's haven't had to face what they've done.
No, they haven't.
No.
And it just, like, even if I agreed with them, I couldn't quote them. I would just, you know, so anyway, I say to Scott Morrison, bugger Moody's and Standard & Poor's and them, like, we really have to find another system other than listen to those rating agencies. So, yeah.
Well, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I think that they've gone too far.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Just quickly, back to another article from the Queensland Parents for Secular State Schools. We were talking before about...
Yeah, that was incredible, wasn't it?
...their letter from Glenview, and... they've got hold, obviously, of a fair selection of the Connect materials, which are supplied by Scripture Union to their volunteers who conduct religious instruction classes. And there's some awful, awful things that these volunteers are doing in classes. And they've highlighted one of these, which is the story of David and Goliath, which a teacher is to conduct with upper primary school kids. And you can read the whole article, but basically tells the David and Goliath story. And of course, David kills Goliath. So just reading here, the teacher has to say, then Goliath moved towards David, but David ran at him, grabbed a stone from his bag and slung it at him. It hit Goliath right in the forehead and Goliath fell to his face on the ground. The teacher then has to ask the David and Goliath actors to act out that scene. And then the teacher says, then David took Goliath's sword, killed him and cut off his head. And then the teacher asks the student David and the student Goliath to act out the head cutting off scene as well. With all of the hullabaloo about the Safe Schools anti-bullying program and what's going on in our schools, you know, meanwhile, teachers are going in and encouraging kids to act out a beheading.
Yeah.
Like, it's acting out, but... It's really?
It might only be acting out, but it is still getting kids to simulate killing someone else.
And it's applauding it. It's saying, good on you, David. Yeah. He killed him. Fantastic. Oh, yeah. Not only did he kill him, he's cut his head off. That's, if you're going to do the job, do it properly.
Yeah.
He didn't.
You know, what I found incredible about this, if we compare this to the Safe Schools program.
Yep.
The Safe Schools program was designed for kids in secondary school, wasn't it?
Mostly, I think.
Yeah.
I think. Certainly mostly aimed at that, yep.
Yeah. This is set up for kids in primary school.
Mm.
You know, I find that incredible that you've got beheadings in primary school, and then you go off to Safe Schools program, and you say, we can't have that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's ridiculous.
You know, like, there might be a really, really bad, evil character that, you know, in order to save the many, you've got to kill him sort of type situation. You know, wouldn't a Christian teaching be to regretfully pull the trigger and kill the guy and then immediately go, wish I didn't have to do that? But,
exactly.
But this Christian story just revels in the fact that not only did he fling the stone and knock him down, but and he's dead, but he's then chopped his head off to, you know, as an absolute enjoyment of the exercise. Like, they're so two-faced in the whole moral thing of it. Like, and that's the sort of moral teaching that they're giving our kids. We have to, dear listener, we have to stop this happening in secular schools. It can't go on.
We do have to. It's got to stop. It's crazy. Yep. It really is crazy.
Quickly to get through our remaining articles, Scott, another one about Western Australian liberals and religious cults taking over one of the pre-selection processes there, and an old hand liberal going, what the hell is going on?
Exactly.
Non-mainstream evangelical Christians are taking over Western Australia. And finally, Scott, a really interesting article that I quite liked, saying that, you know, the current state of the world, Western world, what we're suffering from or operating under, it's as if the people of the Soviet Union had never heard of communism. It's the ideology that's dominating our lives. Says that its anonymity is both a symptom and cause of its power. It has played a major role in a remarkable variety of crises: the financial meltdown, the offshoring of wealth and power, slow collapse of public health and education, resurgent child poverty, epidemic of loneliness, the collapse of ecosystems, the rise of Donald Trump. We respond to these crises as if they emerge in isolation, apparently unaware that they've all been either catalyzed or exacerbated by the same coherent philosophy, a philosophy that has a name but operates namelessly. And that philosophy, Scott, is neoliberalism. So,
yeah, it is a very powerful article. I read it, ladies and gentlemen, and it did have me question quite a few of my own personal beliefs. So it really is, I thoroughly recommend you read it. It is quite a long one, but it is worth it.
Yes. So neoliberalism sees competition as the defining characteristic of human relations. It defines citizens as consumers whose democratic choices are best exercised by buying and selling, a process that rewards merit and punishes inefficiency. It maintains that the market delivers benefits that could never be achieved by planning. Attempts to limit competition are treated as inimical to liberty. Tax and regulation should be minimised. Public services should be privatised. The organisation of labour and collective bargaining by trade unions are portrayed as market distortions that impede the formation of a natural hierarchy of winners and losers. Inequality is recast as virtuous, a reward for utility and a generator of wealth which trickles down to enrich everyone. Efforts to create a more equal society are both counterproductive and morally corrosive. The market ensures that everyone gets what they deserve. Scott, what group have we talked about in this podcast that seems to subscribe to such a theory?
The Institute of Public Affairs.
Exactly. Craziest bunch of neoliberals that you're going to come across. I would have been a neoliberal when I was 19. I was a sort of an Ayn Rand sort of neoliberalist type character, Scott. And
oh yeah, as was I. I mean, I was very much a liberal when I was at university.
Yep.
I was a radical libertarian. Mm. Yeah.
As you get older, you start to sort of see things a bit deeper. So I'm really glad.
You do start to see things a little bit deeper, and I'm glad I made that move too.
Mm. So, great article on neoliberalism, and particularly when you think about how we've described the influence of the Institute of Public Affairs and what they're up to in the halls of power in Canberra, and we need to be on the lookout for that. So,
yes, absolutely.
Right, Scott, well, we've, again, I think we're about the right spot, maybe just a tad longer. Dear listener, thank you for listening to us. And once again, little plug, we desperately, if we're going to get any traction for our magnificent Senate campaign in this election, pop some money into the secular party so we can print some flyers.
We do need some money.
And yes, we can just make a few signs, and honestly, it'll be the most basic stuff. Your money will not be wasted on crazy stuff. It'll be put to good use, and to get us to put the word out there, because let's face it, nobody has heard of the secular party other than a few hundred people, and we really need, with the likes of Rupert Murdoch in charge of our media, you know, you're probably not going to hear from us through the regular media either. So,
no, that's very true.
Every little bit helps. And if you're driving a car and listening, write a little note to yourself, pull over, write a little note, must donate money. Or if you're sitting at home now, do it. Like, don't think you'll do it later because you'll forget. And it is important. So please help us out. And for the moment from the podcast, one other thing, Scott, I'm going to finish with, I didn't tell you about this, Bob Ellis died.
It was a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
He was a real character. Yeah. So he was a speechwriter in the Labor Party, magnificent voice and thinker, some crazy ideas. I heard some stuff about him which caused me to read a little bit more about him, and I heard this thing about him on Richard Feidler's podcast where he read out an excerpt from one of his books about growing old, and I thought that was really good. So I found that little section, and I've recorded it, Scott, and so what I'm going to do is, when we've said our goodbyes, I'm going to start a little sort of three-minute recording of what Bob Ellis had to say about growing old, which I thought was really interesting. And so that'll happen after our goodbyes. So it's goodbye from the Iron Fist until next week.
And goodbye from the Velvet Glove until next week.
What, one may ask, is the difference between youth and age? It is the following, probably. In your youth, you meet every day with 38 or 40 people of your age in school or college. And out of this number,
build friendships, alliances, rivalries, or sexual passions with 18 or 22. These become your intimate world, the field of honour on which you are tested, the jury before which you plead your cause. To these might be added the drama group, the choir, the tennis club, the chess club, the church congregation you are in. You see them less often, once or twice a week, but they add up to 30 or 40 people your age or near it, with whom you are in regular, intimate contact. But once you leave college or go to another town, the 18 or 20 peers you see each day is reduced to 3 or 4, and the choir and tennis club members who migrated with you, likewise, to 1 or 2. It is a crisis of discontinuity, and, though you do not suspect it, the end of youth. If you stay in the same town and half your friends do also, the number of times you see them is drastically reduced. A weekly gathering in a pub will soon peter out as fiancés are acquired, marriages attempted, and mewling infants distract and unsettle your old acquaintance. A weekly poker game can acrimoniously dissipate. The tennis club may persist for a while, but the reducing numbers will mark each year the passing of time. By the age of 38, you will be seeing 2 friends once a month. By 50, 4 friends once a year. High school and college reunions may resurrect, for a time, old intimacies, and spice with a passing adultery a memory of old love. But the numbers you took for granted in your adolescence, never come again. Old age is when there is only you, your wife, a pestiferous neighbour, and the occasional Skyped image of your son or daughter from another hemisphere, and their children speaking a foreign tongue, and the new friends you see twice weekly at the workers' club or once a month in the book club. And the feeling of age derives from the loss of the gang you were once in, at school or college, who you never see now and may write the odd Christmas card to. There are people you love, Barry Humphreys, ghostly character, Sandy Stone, Avers, and you never see them. And there are people you can't stand, and you see them all the time. Age is therefore an unwilled forgetting of the good, the glad, the loved, by broken contact with those you knew and knew well when you were young. A faltering memory begins, and then dementia. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And That way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.